pop yourself a beer or a cold libation. Let me tell you how I wrote this little theme. I went and took a call from Brother Jason, and he tells me that he has a little dream. He says he needs a backwards intro to begin his podcast, and I ask him, what you got? He said, I'll start off with some talking and some moody clips of popcorn fighting fantasy explorations and some groundless exploitation. Kickstarts that I'm watching and some blind unboxings. Full month horror movie marathon. Sometimes I let the dogs come on. Contest and of course, you know it's all about games. That's a slow down. Let's just start with the name. It's the Nerds RPG Variety Podcast. With the other Jason.
Welcome back to Nerds RPG Variety Cast. I'm your host, Jason. Today is pretty much just a call-in show. I put out a show earlier this week where I had a guest on, James from Subclass Act, to talk about solo role-playing games, and I wanted to get these calls out of the way. As far as I know, I do not have any pending calls, so if you've left me a call and haven't heard it by the end of the show, reach out to me and let me know. I don't have a whole lot of news other than that. I am working on the rules for Prohibition era gangster play-by-post thing that we're going to do, and I'll be in touch with those players. I'll give some loose feedback here as that game gets on the way, but I don't really have much to say about it right now. The other game that I've been working on is Visceral. Visceral is a light game you can get off of itch.io. And I think it might be the perfect buddy cop system. I've gotten one playtest in, and it worked very well. So I'm looking forward to further playtesting Visceral and seeing if it stands up. We're trying to pressure test it, do different kinds of things. Fist fights, gunfights, car chases. We're going to Las Vegas next session, so we'll do a whole lot of non-combat things with it just to try to push and bend the system and see what we can do. But so far, it's really impressive, and I think it's going to be the perfect buddy cop system, because the buddy cop system has to be really loose, because the characters are what buddy cops are all about. And when I say buddy cops, I mean that loosely. They don't have to be police officers. In fact, the characters in our test game are professional football players. But the key is the system has to give you enough structure to have a game, and it has to have some real stakes to it. But other than that, we want it to get out of the way. We don't need detailed rules for guns and cars and chases and this and that, because normally our characters in these movies succeed at all these things, but they need to slowly get wore down, and they have to eventually have a chance to fail, and they have to have real consequences. And Visceral gives us all this. Now, it is a lightweight system. It's not designed for campaigns or anything else, but buddy cop movies aren't campaigns either. At least good ones aren't. You know, they really start to fall down after a few movies, as we saw with the Lethal Weapon series. Heck, 48 Hours fell down in the second movie. And sadly, Running Scared never got a second movie. What kind of world do we live in? I mean, you know, rest in peace, Gregory Hines. Amazing actor, amazing tap dancer, amazing guy. What kind of world do we live in where we didn't get more Gregory Hines and Billy Crystal team-ups? That makes me sad. But really, that's about it. Other games are going on. We'll be picking back up with the After the Bomb campaign. I'm looking forward to that. I'm finishing up the Stay Frosty campaign I'm running. We have probably one more session of Stay Frosty, and it's turned out to work really well. I think it would really sing in a convention environment, especially if you had some miniatures and whatnot. I think Stay Frosty would be great. Not that you need miniatures for the combat or any of that, but I think having those, you know, like I'm using visuals. I'm putting up pictures of the monsters and crazy things they're fighting, but being able to put something crazy on the table would really be good for that game. But I think I've wittered on enough here, because I have a number of calls, and I don't want to keep you too long today because the show earlier this week was an hour long. So let's open up that mailbag.
Who's on the phone? Who's on the phone? Who's on the phone? Well, maybe it's your auntie or a joke by your spouse, but the operator's scream is coming from inside the house.
Hi, Hi, Jason. This is Gabe. I'm calling in after listening to episode 610, your St. Patrick's Day episode. And I was struck by, I felt like I was missing some conversation when I heard about movie novelizations. And what a very interesting topic, because once again, we seem to be on similar wavelengths when you talked about how interesting it is to read these movie novelizations. I'm of the same mind. I found out that you actually talk about them in your blog, so I wasn't really missing anything in your show. But I have this really early memory when I was really young reading Return of the Jedi, the novel. And I don't remember if it's actually George Lucas who actually made the novelization. I gotta look it up. But it was then. I have a very vivid memory of a scene that I know was not in the movie. The novel begins with R2-D2, and you get a sense that he's in this like dark cave, and maybe there's like some desert outside. And there's this ominous feeling to it, and there's a description of these like deeply suntanned, weather-stained hands reaching for the dome that is R2-D2's head. And clearly it's a scene. You find out later, of course, spoilers, that it's Luke Skywalker putting his lightsaber into R2-D2 for his master plan later, which is not in the movie. And you wonder if it was in the script. And so many of these are this way. I read the 1982 Conan, the novelization by Lynn Carter and Sprague DeCamp. It's super interesting to see how, I mean, again, these people that work off the novels, they're working off the screenplays. And so it's interesting to see how even so many like quotable lines and scenarios in the movie are just very different. And you don't know if it was in the original screenplay or if it's just how Carter and DeCamp chose to do it in their novelization of Conan the Barbarian. In many ways, I think some of the rough plot things are smoothed out. I don't know if it was just budget or just... you're curious about what choices go into making these changes from the script for the movie. So that brings me to, I'm currently reading the novelization of the worst Conan movie, and I think it should be interesting in many ways. One, it's written by Michael Stackpole, so I picked it up after my Analytic Dice episode on Mercenary Spies and Private Eyes. Who wrote Mercenary Spies and Private Eyes? Michael Stackpole. I thought it'd be interesting. But also, too, is because the legend is, some people think that maybe the movie didn't work out so well, is because they were rewriting the script as they were filming. And so naturally, it's pretty interesting to be like, well, okay, if Stackpole wrote this based on the original script, what is that like? What does that read like? Knowing, if it's true, that script was in a constant state of transition while they were making the movie. And also, incidentally, I haven't even opened it up yet, and I haven't heard anything about it, but Ramsey Campbell novelized the Solomon Kane movie. So I have that one on hand nearby, ready to read as well. So I have one more comment about what was said about immersion. And basically, one of the ways of causing that player-forward immersion, which was some of the language that you used when we spoke, Jason, someone... and I can't remember whose podcast it was, talking about how the dice and the character sheets have been taken away from the players. And interestingly enough, the person who really didn't have a very good time in my Conan game, he has done exactly that. I don't know if he's going to do it again, but he did an experiment where he took all of that away. And so they just said what they did, and he resolved everything behind the screen. Very interesting. I'll just leave it there. Perhaps that's a whole other episode conversation. But thanks again for inviting me on your show and giving me an opportunity to talk about 2D20. And look at this. Thanks,
Gabe. Thank you so much for that call. So I went and pulled out my copy of the Star Wars novelizations. I've got a 3-in-1, the Star Wars trilogy, that has A New Hope, which was by George Lucas, The Empire Strikes Back by Donald F. Glut, and then Return of the Jedi by James Caan. James Caan, interestingly enough, also wrote the novelization for Indiana Jones and Temple of Doom. I have the three Indiana Jones movies, you know, because there are only three of those movies. I've got the novelizations for those three movies as well. Now, I did not have the other ones you had mentioned, interestingly enough, but I have since picked up the novelizations for the 82 Conan. I picked up Conan the Destroyer, of course, and then I picked up the one for the least favorite Conan movie, the 2011 Conan by Michael Stackpole, as well as the Solomon Kane one you mentioned. So I look forward to reading all those when I get to it. I've got a number of other things ahead of them. But yeah, it is really fascinating, these novelizations. And I know I really enjoy them, and I definitely recommend them to people. As far as playing without the character sheets or the dice or any of that and having the Game Master control all that, I do recommend everybody give that a shot. It doesn't have to be a super complex system. It could just be for a one-shot. But I think that play experience is really interesting. It's definitely more work on the Dungeon Master, but I think as the player, it's interesting to do that and to give that a shot. You might like it, you might not, but there's no harm in giving experience a try. So thank you so much for that call, and let's move on to the next one. Actually, let me give some context to this call. This call and the next one are from Carl of the Gemologist Presents, and this one is answering the question of how to handle experience and leveling for players who miss sessions. So they're part of a game, but they miss a few sessions. How do you handle that character as far as experience and leveling goes in regards to the rest of the group? Here's Carl's thoughts.
Why do you suck me in to these conversations, Jason? I did, like, suddenly hear Joe commenting and then your follow-up comment about what to do when a player isn't there and experience points. This is kind of a bone of contention in a number of games sometimes with my groups. And I would say that games that are kind of like WotC D&D, so that everyone has the same amount of XP, and this includes Pathfinder, has not been a good idea to shirk people of XP if they're not there and they miss here and there. I mean, someone who regularly misses, that's a whole different story. Usually they're gracious enough to say, hey, I don't have time for the game, and I'll peace out. But most of the time, it's just someone who misses a few here and there, and you got to keep them up. If not, I've run into arguments where, well, I'm now falling behind, blah, blah, blah. Now, TSR era, they're more conducive to like a drop-in, drop-out, because you get XP. The XP is different. It's based more on gold and what your group does in that short amount of space. And XP varies, which is really nice. So I think I've also decided, like, for example, in Warhammer Fantasy, the best game out there, 4th edition especially, that, you know what, if you're not there, you don't get XP because you're not doing the thing, because it's milestone XP. You don't get XP. Well, it's milestone XP based on things that your character does, whether it's investigative or defeating or hitting a goal in the story. It's not necessarily beating monsters, although sometimes that's there if it's a powerful leader, not just killing bunches of goblins or orcs or skaven or whatever. But if you kill like a leader, that's a milestone. It's a significant change in the story. And if you're not there, well, you don't get the XP. Now, I've tried to emphasize, hey, if you're not going to be there, send me your character. I'll try to run it, or someone can run it, because it's not that challenging. But, you know, with games, especially like Pathfinder, where it's very complicated, it's hard to do. But in Warhammer, it's not so bad to do. Although sometimes people are like, well, I don't understand the way that character works, so we're not going to play it. I guess it depends on your relationship with the other players and what they think. So anyway, yeah, alternatively, you can do like what Kevin Madison does, and, you know, you're just disappearing, you're not there, if it's an ongoing game. But see, again, it's like in Warhammer Fantasy, if you're not there, and I guess the thing is, in Warhammer Fantasy, for example, or a game that's kind of more skill-based, I mean, you're not falling behind so much in power level. So, I mean, yes, there's a big difference between a fourth tier career character and a first tier career character, but, you know, one or two tier difference is not going to make a big deal. So anyway, those are my thoughts, and I hope that makes sense, and I'll talk to you later.
Carl, I really appreciate that call. Great points you bring up, and it really does matter on what system you're using on how to handle it when a player misses a session. Folks, if you have ideas on what to do when players miss sessions in regards to their character's experience and leveling, please call in and join the conversation. Now I'm going to switch to another call from Carl. Normally, I don't play calls that come in right after an episode goes out, but this came in just before I finished editing this episode, so I decided to include it. This call from Carl is in regards to the solo play episode I recently put out with James over at Subclass Act.
Hey, Jason and James. Thank you for that talk on solo play. It has definitely inspired me to try to do something like that. I've gotten some solo play stuff and toyed with the idea. I think the ones I've looked at have had their own, well, Walking Dead has a solo play option, and Star Trek put out a whole Captain's Log series for a solo play, well, a book that has different covers, and those seem very interesting to do. I think they have their own oracle or way of generating things, or do you need another oracle on the side? I don't know, but I did think of, especially when I was listening in the car, of doing like a solo play with Warhammer Fantasy and picking up one of the oracles that you mentioned and or suggested and running with that. It'd be really, you could do everything random. You could randomly make a character, maybe end up being like a peasant or beggar, and then go from there. All right. Thank you so much for the podcast.
Carl, thank you so much for the feedback. I can't speak for the Modiphius games. I would think they should be self-included. Once you buy that solo kit for them, that should give you what you need. The same for like the One Ring. When you buy that Strider kit, that should give you what you need in theory. But I don't know because I don't own those products. But any of the things we talked about would work with Warhammer Fantasy or any game, really. I hope you do explore some solo play, and you talk about it over on your show, or call back and let me know how it goes. Either way, if you do on your show, I'll point people that way. If you call in here, then obviously I'll be happy to play the call. I look forward to hearing other people's experiences of solo play as well. What oracle do you prefer? Call in and let us know. This last call I have today is a bit of a long one, almost 9 minutes, but it is from Anthony, also known as Runeslinger, of the Casting Shadows blog and podcast, Runeslinger YouTube channel. And Anthony called in to respond to comments, particularly the ones by Kevin, the author of Burn 2D6, about the use of meta currency with 2D20 games and the idea of, does that pull you out of the game while you're fiddling with the meta currency? And I played that call on St. Patrick's Day, and now this is Anthony's response to that, or thoughts on that. It's not really like a adversarial thing. It's just in response to that call. So anyway, I'm going to turn it over to Anthony.
Hey, Jason. It's Anthony calling in from the road. And this is a call in response to Kevin from Analytic Dice, his call in on your St. Patrick's Day mailbag show. Not a direct response, more of an observation of what he shared about his personal experience and how that ties in with the effect of games like 2D20 on what's commonly called immersion. What I heard in listening to his example at the beginning, I heard a great representation of the experience of what I've been calling in my podcast engagement, right? We're lit up, we're connected to, and really enjoying the use of the mechanisms of play. This is an expression of our attention. It grips us, it causes focus, and it's the same feeling of immersion that people talk about more commonly when they talk about immersion in character. And it's why we get these arguments about things when we limit ourselves to the idea that immersion is only a singular experience, that all people experience it the same way. In a sense, they do experience that feeling in the same way, but what triggers the feeling and what they're paying attention to achieve that feeling, well, it does change. So this is an example of why I came up with having attention as the umbrella term, immersion as the passive side, the reactive side to information that we pay attention to and fall into, right? And have our focus planted on. And that engagement is the active side, where we're thinking about things, we're using mechanisms, we're rolling dice, we're interacting with each other, right? And that can be just as gripping, cause just as much focus, and ignoring just as many other things around us as the first one. So, thought that was great. Then we get into a description of, well, agency, right? These mechanisms mean we don't just have to roll our dice and take it, we can get involved, right? So this is, again, another step away from that notion of in-character play as character. But as Kevin, I think, rightly points out, it's not necessarily a step away from a type of in-character play. And this is the type that I've referenced of in-character as author, where you get to make some decisions about how things affect the character on a broader level than, let's say, that the character has on their own, right? So in a more authorial position, you can decide, you know, I'm going to use these resources now so that I can achieve a greater effect, or so that I can, you know, affect this die roll in some way, right? These are not thoughts that the character is having. So this is not an as-character experience. But the player can still be limited to the information of the situation that is only gained through the character, right? The decisions they're making are not on a higher meta level like a game master. They are instead generated and drawn from the information that they have earned in play as the character. It's still in character play. It's just a different vector for in-character play. So it's a good highlight of maybe what the different experience is for someone who solely wants to focus on the experience of the character, and they don't want to have any currencies to spend, they don't want to be able to adjust any die rolls, they don't want to have any luck or bennies or any of those things. They just want to get information that the character could get, and they want to be able to act in the way that the character would act. Full stop. So in character as character, compared to being able to have some of those authorial benefits of changing the situation, but not access to secrets of the game master or secrets from behind the screen or however you want to think about it. So I think that was really cool. Where I might want to point out something to think about is in the notion of, I had this experience, so I think other people will have this experience. I don't find this really, you know, turns out to be true in practice, especially when we consider the large number of people who play. And it often comes along with the idea of when someone says, this mechanism can have this effect, people hear it or react to it as, this mechanism does have this effect, right? So while when I play 2D20 games, I definitely feel that little sting of disappointment that I'm now going to be spending time in character as author, in the writer's room, as it were, rather than in character as character. In fact, this affects me so strongly that I will choose to run 2D20 games and have a great time rather than play them. So, yes, these mechanisms definitely can affect a player, no matter how familiar they get with their use, can affect the player by shifting them into a different vector of play, which they may not necessarily enjoy as much as the next person. Right? If you enjoy in-character as character play and in-character as author play equally, then this isn't going to bother you at all. But if you do have a preference, then it can. So there's a huge difference between does do something and can do something. And there's a lot of nuance between players and what they're looking for. There's also a lot of nuance among the 2D20 games. So the experience of Conan, generally, a lot of the expenditures can serve as an analog for action, much like we've talked about in the past about rolling dice and Palladium. Like, it can feel like a replacement or a metaphor for the character's action, right? It can be very gripping, very engaging. Some other 2D20 games, however, a point expenditure is not a simple thing. It's not a metaphor for an action. It's a call for decision, and some of them are calls for discussion, and some of them require some, you know, approval. And so this is definitely taking you away from in character as character, moving you through in character as author, and can even push you completely out into out of character discussions as players about the expenditure of points and the setting of difficulties and the use of challenge dice. There are many different flavors and mechanisms involved in the broad umbrella of 2D20 games, and they can strike people very differently and can have a different impact or degree of impact. Anyway, this is too long a call, and I guess I had a lot more to say than I thought. But anyway, I really thought it was a good comment. I don't want to come across as overly critical, just continuing the conversation. Anyway, thanks for an interesting St. Patrick's Day episode. I hope everything is going well with you, and we'll talk to you soon.
I don't really have anything to add to that other than to say thank you so much for that call, Anthony. I really appreciate it. I think it's an interesting discussion, and we are going to try to have another panel discussion to discuss these kind of topics, specifically with 2D20 system, so or the various 2D20 games, I should say, because as everybody's mentioned, they do vary game to game. But I want to thank all my callers. That's really all I have today. So thank you to everybody that's tuned in. Thank you to Ray Otis for the Coffee Cup Clip Art, TJ for the wonderful music. And until I talk to you next time, be excellent to each other.
And remember, folks, if you sent a call in to Jason and you haven't heard it on this episode, have no fear. It will appear.
Joke about your spouse, but the operator's screaming it's coming from inside the house. What's in the box? What's in the box? What's in the box? What's in the box? Well, the audience is pretty sure he took a pretty head, and the only question left is if I could shoot him dead. Bring on the gore, bring on the gore. Is a dice man and your moil is by the tipper, and I'm assuming that your partner back there in the wood chipper. Don't look away. Don't look away. Don't look away. Well, the zombies are arising and the world has gone to hell. We're living for the dying and we're dying for the train wreck.